Welcome to the Omics Exchange. I'm Angela Page.
Large-scale sequencing initiatives around the globe are generating massive volumes of clinical genomic data that have the potential to inform research into human health and disease. But controlling access to these data is currently a cumbersome endeavor. Researchers must be properly authorized, and their intended use must match the dataset's consented use. The GA4GH Data Use and Researcher Identities Workstream aims to create the standards required for efficient access control. The group has now released two standards that help streamline and automate this process, Data Use Ontology and GA4GH Passport Specification. For this episode, we're speaking with the product leads of these independent deliverables, Melanie Courteau and Craig Voisin, about the challenges presented by data access control and the solutions being developed within their teams. Melanie is a coordinator for metadata standards and the archival infrastructure and technology team at Emble EBI. She became involved with GA4GH in 2016 and now co-leads development of the data use ontology standard. Craig is a software engineer at Google, where he leads a team that provides federated access solutions across public clouds. He joined GA4GH in 2018 and co-leads development of the GA4GH Passport standard. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
To get us started, what does the landscape of data access look like right now?
So right now, unfortunately, the process to get access to data is really, really long. It takes between 2 to 6 weeks to actually retrieve the data you may be interested in. Once you have found the data set you are interested in, you need to request access to that data from a data access committee, which is the organization managing the access rights. It means you need first identify and get approval from somebody in your institution who is an institutional signing official. And that person is the legal responsible for your usage of the data sets. Then you need to write a description for your project and how you intend to use the data, agree to terms and conditions. And this is all done manually in plain text at the moment.
Just to build on what Melanie was saying, there are multiple stages to data access that can be challenging. So one type of request is just being able to discover what data sets are out there that are useful to apply to, especially when it takes 2 to 6 weeks to apply for a data set. It's very helpful to know, should I spend the effort it takes to apply to these 10 data sets or not? Should I focus down on these other ones? And then there's another type of access, which is I would like to have full read access. I'd like to be able to read the bytes, plug it into my analysis pipeline so that I can determine whether or not my hypothesis holds true for a particular variant, or I'm trying to analyze a particular cohort to see what they have in common. And so now I need full read access to the data. And this has the tightest data governance controls, especially because it could expose personally identifiable information like genome sequences. Once a researcher has applied for direct read access to the bytes and they've been approved, there are even more hurdles to access it. Where and how do I need to go to even get a login to be able to access the data? Where's the data located? What tools and protocols do I use to read it? None of these issues have anything to do with the data format or the data itself. They're merely prerequisites to be able to access the data. So these are examples of different types of access, but there are even more flavors that are possible based on the institution or even the governing bodies across countries that have certain policies in place.
What about the data access committees or DACs? What challenges do they face?
The Data Access Committee, they're really the gatekeepers to data access. So they're the group of people that have to check that the requests that come in can be matched against the data use limitation on data sets. So they have to evaluate what the request is about versus what the data set says. And they have to do that manually. So it's all about interpreting the form, analyzing the form, and making a judgment as to whether access should be granted or not. This is a very important step that helps safeguarding the patient privacy, the data confidentiality, while ensuring the usage of the data is done in compliance with the original consent forms from the patient. It takes time and expertise. And as we mentioned earlier, even once you found the data set and you are sending your data access in, it can take 2 to 6 weeks to just get the data shipped back.
And just to add to that as well, these are the kind of timeframes it takes today. But as we know, the number of data sets is growing and the number of applications to access that data is growing as well. So the scalability of the DAC becomes also a concern. As we onboard twice as many researchers as before, how do we make this scale so the DAC can keep up with this workload?
Both of you are involved with the GA4GH Data Use and Researcher Identities Workstream, or DURI. What are this group's objectives and goals?
Well, you've heard from both Craig and I about some of the issues that the researchers are facing when they're trying to access data today. The Data Use and Researcher ID Workstream, or DURI, aims at streamlining that process. Improving data availability will ultimately increase its reusability. So our role within the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health is really designing specification that institutions can apply consistently across. So the idea is not so much from us to develop tooling, because that's very much an institution-specific decision, but more describing the desired behavior of those tools. And if we all agree on what we're trying to do and how to do it, at the end, the way it's actually physically and technically implemented doesn't matter so much, because you know what the input and what the outputs are. And together, we believe that this is actually the only way the wealth and the amount of data the genomics community is generating can be efficiently leveraged to improve human health.
I think it's great to see the size and engagement of the global community that's trying to make a difference here. Automation can bring standardization to the process and the controls, and that would really help researchers focus on the research, not the data access process.
So what does automation mean in this context of data access, and why is this the approach that the DURI workstream is focusing on?
As Craig mentioned, there's really more data coming your way and more people wanting to access the data. So if you start multiplying the number of data access committee per request by the number of requests, by the number of people wanting to make those requests, and you imagine that each of those requests has to follow a different process with a different type of form using a different tool, this is becoming a really big hindrance to actually reusing the data in any sort of efficient way. So one of the things that's worth highlighting when we talk about automation, we are not talking about 100% fully automatic process. So we are not saying we should just free all the data without any sort of control. We know that the privacy and respecting the consent that the patient gave us at the start of the process is really critical in sharing data worldwide. However, when we look at the type of access request and the type of restriction on the data sets nowadays, 80% of those could be standardized and help triage access requests for the data access committee. So the goal is not to automate absolutely everything. The goal is really to make the load on those data access committee lighter.
Automation can streamline the application process to produce faster results for getting access. It can reduce some of the risks related to incorrect use by reducing how much interpretation is done based on text and making it easier to go through this process. And it can remove some of the access barriers to actually conduct the research. So all those things help, as well as the scalability that's coming as we continue to grow how many researchers are accessing data.
So how would this all work? What would the ideal data access process look like?
Well, if we are doing our work very well, nobody should know about it. Researchers can do their research. They can search, deposit, request data seamlessly from within their own favorite application. They don't need to know anything around data access, fetching the data from a specific location, logging in. Behind the scenes, it should just come together for them. And that happens in less than 24 hours. This would allow researchers to really focus on their research without having to deal with any of the technical hurdles in getting the data.
Melanie, I know you lead development of the Data Use Ontology, or the DUO standard. Can you explain how DUO fits into this vision?
We talked a little bit about the need to manually assess textual access requests and how that's a heavy process, both for the person who's filling in those forms to request data and for the data access committee who has to interpret them. So the Data Use Ontology, or DUO, provides a set of terms that are stable and unambiguous to represent those data access limitations. And they can be used at different stages in the process. So when you're trying to find a data set of interest, ideally you retrieve only those data sets that you can actually have access to. And then you can, for example, restrict your search for data sets that are compatible with a specific research purpose. So, for example, if you are a diabetes researcher, you can say this data set was consented for diabetes specific research, which is a subtype of a dual disease specific research. And finally, the last step in the process, when a researcher comes and requests that data set, they can very clearly, very unambiguously say, I want to do diabetes research. And by using that same data use ontology term to describe that same thing, you suddenly don't have the need for that interpretation of plain text forms anymore.
So the goal is to arrive at these unambiguous, stable terms, as you mentioned. What is the process to develop these terms?
We had a lot of discussion. Let me take an example. What does not-for-profit mean? Does that mean using it for non-profit? Does that mean you are part of a non-for-profit organization? How does not-for-profit relate to non-commercial? And so we've made one term that encompasses all those cases. And when researchers that deposit data use that term, the Data Access Committee can really be confident that they really understand the meaning behind it. So each of the terms in DUO has a human readable definition as well. And the idea is very much standardizing the understanding and getting that shared understanding of DUO. And as you're saying, even if we don't fully automate the process, it's much easier if you're part of a Data Access Committee and you say, oh, this is a diabetes restricted data set. Oh, that person wants to study diabetes. It's very clear cut that you need to let that through. And it's not going to take you 1 or 2 hours reading text and trying to understand the meaning behind the text. Furthermore, we distribute DUO as a machine level file. And these software tools really automatically can compare the DUO terms on the access request versus the DUO terms on the data set and make a determination. Should you be granted access or not, and propose that determination to the data access committees. And I should add that DUO is also being applied right now in real life production systems. So for example, as of today, the European Phenome Genome Archive, EGA, has tagged around 500 data sets with the DUO terms. And based on this success, EGA is now requiring that DUO terms be added on all new submissions, whether they're coming through the CRG in Spain or EMBL-EBI in the UK.
So Craig, you lead the development of the GA4GH passport standard. Could you tell us a bit more about this and how it fits into the data access process?
Passports are about improving the quality and consistency of controls that are in place for access across the industry, while at the same time streamlining the process to prove that it was fit for use. So I think it's worth talking a little bit about the analogy here. If I'm working within my home organization, there's probably a way that my organization has me identify myself. There's probably a consistent way that I can get access to various pieces of data or my inbox or whatever needs to be done. Where the complication comes in is when you start crossing over environments, where you start going cross organizations or cross platforms. And it's a bit like if I need to go to my corner store, I don't need to carry a passport with me in order to do that because it's all within my home area. But as soon as I cross borders, there's going to be a new process that's in place to determine whether it's fit for me to be able to access that country, for example, in the physical form. And so we're just trying to carry that analogy into things for researchers. A researcher passport, a GA4GH passport, allows an individual to identify themselves and carry their permissions with them between their locations and environments. And we do this by playing on that analogy of a visa within a passport. As a researcher, I can build up different visas in my passport. They can identify me as a bona fide researcher, which is a general term. It can identify my home organization and be signed off, digitally signed, that can be verified that these things are genuine. And then as data access committees grant my access requests, I can then build up a set of controlled access grants that give me read access to those data sets.
Right. And I can imagine there's an enormous impact from the researcher's side of having a universal digital identification that works everywhere.
And so the more people that are on this global GA4GH passport network, the more opportunities there are to streamline these more complex use cases. And that means that you can actually combine data responsibly in ways that it hasn't been before to make new discoveries. The GA4GH passport standard was just ratified in October 2019, and we're already seeing a lot of work that's being done to enable discovery and read access on datasets. In fact, there are over 5,000 datasets today that use passports in some capacity to modernize and streamline access verification. I would expect to see the number of datasets and the methods to acquire the appropriate access to grow considerably across the global community in 2020. So this is going to be very exciting to see.
How do you see these two standards working together to improve the data access process?
One thing we need to do this year is trying to marry those two processes to really align them. At this point in time, we have the pieces, and it's really about bringing them and fitting them together. We are really trying to make sure that on the one hand side, you can handle authentication and authorization via passports, and on the other hand side, you have a process for the data access committee to review automatically geotagged elements. So it's going to be really exciting to see how we can really merge the two processes in having one common workflow for researchers to get access to their data.
I think it takes a lot of community involvement because obviously there are different practices in place across the globe, but it's going to be an interesting space because once we know the duocodes, what is involved with each individual data set, we can both streamline the DAC process to be able to get rights to it, but also carry some of this content inside the passport itself as proof and evidence for access. So it can be used directly, potentially, to be able to get access to certain types, different levels of access. But I think overall, what we're going to see first probably is more about streamlining the DAC process to get a visa that says the researcher should have read access to the data set. So I suspect that's where a lot of this will start, and then we'll evolve that based on needs across the community.
So how will these standards and this whole automation process improve the research endeavor as a whole?
At the end, it's all about making the data flow faster to improve its reuse and eventually analysis and the applications to make discoveries from those data that we can integrate from multiple institutes and sources. And, you know, this is really the only way we think you can have a lasting impact on human health. You pull the data together, merge it, integrate it, analyze it seamlessly. You don't need to be concerned about the technicalities. Where is it coming from? What format is it in? You can all have access to it and really use it for your research.
Well, I look forward to accelerating research while putting even more controls and transparency in place for the data donors and participants. You know, we start this journey with researchers themselves, but I'd like to see a day when we see the same technologies be used in clinical settings with patients. The system can provide participants and patients direct access to their own data and provide mechanisms to consent for research use, and then see where their own data has been used across research projects. This can encourage even more people to step forward and make huge impact on the health and well-being of us all.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much for organizing that.
Thank you for listening to the Omics Exchange, a podcast of the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health. The Omics Exchange podcast is produced by Stephanie Lee and Katie Forgey, with music created by Rishi Nag. GA4GH is the international standards organization for genomics, aimed at accelerating human health through data sharing. I'm Angela Page, and this is the Omics Exchange.